I certainly did not read Deepak Chopra and think, how am I going to bring this guy down? It was completely happenstance.
Imagine you're Deepak Chopra, best-selling author, alternative medicine advocate, licensed physician. One day, you check your Google alerts and you find that a scientific study out of Canada has shown that not only are the contents of your Twitter account bullshit, but they are indistinguishable from the randomly created output of a Deepak Chopra quote generator. That study actually happened. Gordon Pennycook, an associate professor of behavioral science, undertook the study in 2015 at Regina University in Canada. The study went on to win the Ig Nobel Peace Prize for improbable research the next year. On this episode of Scammapalooza, I talked to Gordon about the inspiration for his work, how one decides what is and isn't bullshit, and get his thoughts on Chopra's reaction to the study. If you enjoy the episode, please share it and tell your friends. My name's Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. How did you come to study bullshit? How did that become an area of study for you?
That's a great question. Like many people at around that time, when I was younger, I was exposed to like skepticism, I guess. You know, and I mean, I would probably describe myself at one point as being sort of the militant atheist type, I guess. You know, I was into arguing about religion and stuff like that. Over the years, I stopped caring as much about the arguments, and I started becoming more interested in why people believed or didn't. And the kind of psychology of it. And so I was doing my PhD in cognitive psychology, and one of the things I started working on was the nature of belief, and one of the first projects has to do with religious belief. What that work was mostly about was about differences in the way that people think. And some people tend to, as you may have experienced in your own lives, and I don't know where you would put yourself on this, although I'm not sure that people are all that good at assigning themselves to the categories, but some people are more intuitive, right? They like go with their gut feelings and their emotions, and they, you know, and that's good for some things, you know, like empathy, for example, and, you know, it's not always negative, but some people tend to be more analytic and reflective and deliberative. And sometimes that means they're more logical and rational, but not always. And it kind of depends. And so I was doing a lot of that work. And then, I started doing research on things like paranormal beliefs, conspiracy beliefs, you know, expanding out to different types of things that people vary on. And there's lots of interesting questions there. And what happened was I came across this website called wisdomofchopra.com. Deepak Chopra is this new age guru. You know, I don't think he would describe himself that way, but he kind of writes books about things like quantum consciousness and et cetera. And he was on Oprah and he was pretty famous. But he uses really kind of abstract language, you know. One example of a tweet that he wrote was, attention and intention are the mechanics of manifestation. Okay, pretty hard to parse out what that is. And I came across this website called wisdomofchopra.com, and what it does is it takes, you know, these kind of abstract buzzwords from Deepak Chopra's Twitter feed and then puts them together randomly in a sentence. Okay, and so like an example would be, hidden meaning transforms unparalleled abstract beauty. Okay. So that's a random sentence. Sounds like maybe it means something, but it's just, you know, if there's any meaning, it's totally incidental. It's not there. And so I was just like, boy, I wonder if people think that these things are actually profound. And then we started doing projects on it. And this is where I got into like the philosophy of what makes something bullshit and so on.
So because a lot of people I talk to about bullshit, they come in as interested in the topic of bullshit, you know, and then sort of explore that field. But it sounds like for you, it was very much about these, as you said, you started with this idea of profundity and what is and isn't profound and how people perceive things as being profound. And then the label of bullshit was something that came a little later on.
Yeah, that's right. It was more like, I'm interested in the nature of people's beliefs and judgments and so on. And this was another way to get at understanding that, essentially. So it wasn't about, it wasn't like, I wonder if I can find a way to figure out who is not receptive to bullshit. It's more mundane than that, really. Yeah.
In your paper, it's probably your most famous paper, on the reception of and detection of pseudo-profound bullshit. You use the definition of bullshit made famous by the philosopher Harry Frankfurt, that bullshit is, rather than being a lack of truth, it's a lack of concern for the truth. Is that the definition that you used in constructing this study into why people find what is essentially nonsense to be profound?
Well, it's kind of the other way around. That is in the sense that I first found the thing I wanted to ask people about, and then I had to think about what is this actually about? What is the underlying, what is this measuring, essentially?
Mm.
Okay. And then that's when I discovered the philosophical kind of arguments about the nature of bullshit. You know, I mean, I think this is part of the reason why there hadn't been any research on the psychology of bullshit before that. Because it's like, you have to really delve into the meaning of these sorts of concepts in a more philosophical way to really kind of grasp that. And I discovered, you know, very quickly Frankfurt's work and other work that's related to that. You know, I really thought it was a really good way to think about how we communicate. You know, it is a big difference. Like, so if someone lies, it implies that they care about the truth, you know, because they're doing something to try to subvert it. But really, that's not really what's going on with this sort of thing. It's not like Deepak Chopra's not lying to people in a meaningful sense. He's just communicating in a way to make things sound really important and interesting. But, you know, maybe he's saying things that if at best they're mundane and maybe they're just meaningless.
So that then creates a really big question for you as a researcher, which is, how do you know how Deepak Chopra feels about the truth? How do you know that he has a lack of concern for the truth when writing?
Yeah, that's a great question. This is the criticism that Frankfurt faced in the philosophical literature about his definition, is that it implies some kind of knowledge of intent. And even for the people who are bullshitting, as it were, they might not even really know. Or it's probably not they don't care at all about the truth. They probably have some concern, but it's outweighed by, you know, making sure that they get more followers online or whatever it is. That does make it complicated. And so some people have tried to define bullshit more on whether people are communicating with regards to evidence and things of that nature. You know, it's a little bit nebulous. It's because then how do you, who gets to define whether it counts as evidence or not? For our purposes, for the underlying psychology, it doesn't matter a huge amount. You know what I mean? So in our own, the way that we assessed bullshit receptivity in the studies was using, like I mentioned, those random sentences. And so we do know the intent for that. They were literally constructed without any concern for the truth because they're random. And so that it fits the definition that we offered for what something is called, why you call something bullshit. But you could, if someone came along and said, you know, I don't think we should call it bullshit. We should call it interest in woo or something or whatever. It doesn't really matter. It's still you just change the name of it. It's still the underlying phenomenon is still the same. People are assuming things are profound, but even though they don't understand them, you can call that whatever you want.
Yeah. When you talk about pseudo-profound bullshit and you make a clear distinction between things which are actually meaningful and things which are gibberish, I think you referred to them
nonsense,
as gibberish.
Yeah.
You have things which are, the example in the unparalleled transforms meaning, beauty, hidden, abstract. It doesn't make sense on a synaptic level.
Yeah,
and so it's not useful for the purposes of this study. It's got to be able to be passed off as meaningful, even if it isn't necessarily meaningful. Is that right?
That's right. That's kind of the essence of it, exactly, where it's it's written in such a way that the person who's being communicated with would assume that there's probably some intended meaning or there's something that's trying to be said.
Yeah.
But in reality, there isn't. Yeah.
It reminds me of the paper, I think it's Deeper Into Bullshit by G.A. Cohen. He makes the same points that you do about Harry Frankfurt and the fact that you're really sort of defining the state of mind of bullshitters rather than actually what bullshit is. Mm-hmm. And he offered a different type of bullshit, which he referred to tongue-in-cheek as unclarifiable unclarity, which mm-hmm. is things which are unclear and cannot be made more clear without changing the meaning of words that you've just spoken. And he kind of offered that up as an alternative to Harry Frankfurt's definition. I think both Deepak Chopra's tweets and also the randomly generated words definitely fall into that category of things which are unclarifiable, unclarity. They're not just unclear, because we all say things which are unclear. They're unclear, and it's impossible to make them more clear without backtracking and say, no, actually, what I really meant was, which is Deepak Chopra's response to your study, is to go, oh, no, what I actually meant was, and to try and twist his words into some semblance of meaning.
I agree completely. That is that base, that definition also fits what we did.
Yeah. Right. I feel really proud of myself because I, you know, I'm not an academic and I read both papers and then I made the little connection and now I have the person who wrote the study. I feel like I'm back in university and you just said, you know, excellent connection, Nicholas, in the comments of my,
You get A+ for that one. Good job.
Great. I saw on your website, you're not taking graduate students at the moment, but. You know, if you were like someone who did a liberal arts degree 20 years ago, fly me over.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, so can we let's actually break down the study just a little bit. So you have these two types of sentence. You have ones which Deepak Chopra actually said on his Twitter feed, and then you have ones which were randomly generated by a computer, by a website. How then did you test how profound people found either of these?
Well, we very simply asked them. We always define what it means for something to be profound, you know, of deep meaning and great significance, or which is like a dictionary definition of the term. And we just asked people, we said, you know, we're kind of interested in how people, you know, experience how things are profound or meaning in things. I can't remember exactly what it was. Something to do with meaning creation, I think is how we described it. And then we just gave them randomized like sentences. Like they got some, in some studies they got 10, maybe 20 sentences or whatever. And then we just asked them, you know, from 1 to 5, 5 being like extremely profound, 1 being not at all profound. How profound do you find this sentence? In some studies, in the very first studies, we just gave people the randomized ones from, and actually it's from two sources. The one was from the Wisdom of Chopra website. And there's another one that's called the New Age Bullshit Generator, and it has a different kind of corpus, but it's the same randomized sentences. So it says things about quantum soup and whatever. And so we gave them those sentences, and then we basically wanted to see if, you know, as you'd expect, if it actually is measuring how receptive people are to bullshit, then you'd expect people, for example, who have more verbal intelligence to rate them as less profound, or people who are more analytic and reflective to rate them as less profound, and like, people who believe in paranormal things are more likely to rate them as being profound and so on. And we found all those things.
That sounds, though, like three very different things. The first thing that you mentioned about...
this is verbal intelligence, like understanding words, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to me, verbal intelligence feels very different from belief in paranormal abilities or being even analytical, because it sort of goes down to being able to understand the words themselves and their meaning, whereas someone who might have very high verbal intelligence but believes in paranormal, that feels like that's measuring very, very different things when you look at those three things.
That another A+ for that one, Nicholas.
Thank you.
Because that was the point of it, in the sense that we wanted to try to get as many different elements of what would be things that ought to relate to these sorts of judgments if they were genuinely about like whether people are receptive to bullshit. And so, for example, having a good verbal intelligence means that you understand what the words mean better and are therefore probably more likely to recognize that even though you know what the words mean, reading them together doesn't mean anything itself. But also we expected that people who are more intuitive, that kind of go with their gut, would be more impressed by how the words sounded, but less likely to think about what they actually mean. And so that's why reflective thinking is related. And then paranormal belief, that's like, you know, that's just like another similar sort of people who are really interested in paranormal things tend to be more intuitive, but they also, they kind of like that sort of thing. And so it's related in that sort of way.
Yeah. So it's, I guess it's a difference then between the having the ability to actually interrogate the meaning of what you're reading and the ability to interrogate the meaning. Some people just don't have the ability to actually pick apart what that means. And so they have to, much like me reading, you know, a lot of these papers is that I will read a paragraph. Well, I don't understand that, but I'll just have to assume that the person knows what they're talking about and move on, as opposed to someone who actually, if they were willing to, would be capable of actually picking something apart and going, oh, hang on, that doesn't actually mean something. Yeah,
that's right. It's the distinction between the ability and the willingness.
You know,
some people have the ability, but not the willingness to reflect. And if you have a deficit in one or the other, then that's when you end up falling for bullshit or whatever.
And am I right in remembering that people who found Deepak Chopra's tweets to be very, very profound would also find the meaningless sentences very, very profound, and people who found them to be not at all profound found neither profound? Mm-hmm. Is that right? That there's a very clear correlation between how profound people find these two types of sentences?
That's right. So like in the second study, what we did is we added these kind of real world versions. The idea there is that like we weren't sure if there's something really weird or idiosyncratic with our random sentences that made them like unnatural or something. And so we took actual tweets from Deepak Chopra, randomized them also into the mix. And it's not just that they're correlated, they're psychologically indistinguishable. That is, you wouldn't be able to tell from the data which ones are which. They're correlated in the same way that like basically it's like if I asked a bunch of questions that we're trying to get at neuroticism, you know, sometimes you ask a question that's not about neuroticism, it's about like agreeableness. And so it's assessing a different underlying thing. In this case, the random sentences and Deepak Chopra's tweets were assessing the same thing, which is bullshit receptivity. They were correlated the same with everything else, and the correlation between them was 0.9 in the high scores of 1, right, in the correlation. So they were essentially the same thing. But was the case, though, to give Deepak Chopra some credit, his tweets were rated as slightly more profound than the random sentences, but there was no cases where people essentially thought only his tweets were profound and they didn't think the random sentences were profound. If you like the random sentences, then you like Deepak Chopra's tweets.
Yeah. And I think I would imagine that when Deepak Chopra is constructing a tweet, he is not randomly putting words together. He doesn't have a mind like a random generator that just putting these, you know, cosmos, quantum, you know, put them all, you know, and just spewing them out. That there is somewhere in there some sense of meaning or feeling or emotion or something that he is trying to put into this that the random generator isn't. It can't be completely devoid of the intent for meaning. Surely he's not a robot.
Actually, the example I gave before, which was attention and intention are the mechanics of manifestation. I've used that example a lot in talks, and I think I know what he tried to say, which is essentially, if you don't pay attention, you might make a mistake, I think, is what that generally means. But it's not profound, right? Like, that is like somebody who is high in verbal intelligence would maybe be able to figure out what the intended meaning there is, but it's not, certainly not as profound as it sounds. Like, it's not, actually, it's pretty mundane. Like, we know that if you don't pay attention, you're going to make a mistake. That's just kind of what that means almost. It's almost circular. So I think this goes back to what Cohen said. Like, I'm not sure that that's unclarifiable bullshit, but it definitely has it looks like bullshit basically, and it acts like it in psychological terms.
Yeah, it reminds me of, and I've mentioned this several times on the podcast, the linguist Paul Grice's cooperative principle. The very short version is that there are these sort of unwritten assumptions that we make about each other when speaking. I assume that you're going to tell me the truth, you're going to make sense, you're not going to give me too much information, and you're going to give me all of the information that I require. And everything you say is going to be relevant. And that's what I assume, you know. So when you say something, I assume, even if perhaps you're not being completely truthful, if you sort of say, I'm so hungry I can eat a horse, okay, he's lying, but I assume he means to tell the truth goes from there. And so he talks about these violations, which is where you break the rules, but you break them in a way in which, with the sort of intent to deceive, essentially, to be deceptive. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't have to be a lie. It can be saying something that is nonsensical or giving too much information or giving irrelevant information in an attempt to disguise something. So in this case, you've got this truism, but you've wrapped it up in such fancy, nonsensical language with a lot of irrelevant details that it is much more impenetrable and sounds much more profound than it really is.
Yeah, and I think that's actually that's the thing that I was interested in. You know, that's what makes it, in a certain sense, if somebody thinks that our random sentences that we use in the study are profound, it's not that important. You know what I mean? Like, they, if that makes them happy, then, you know, go for it or whatever. But it, when it comes down to cases where people are selling medical supplements or like all the other garbage online, or buying books about that are purportedly self-help books, but they don't actually offer any advice or whatever, that's when it becomes a problem, where people actually are taking advantage of others by using these sorts of tactics.
Yeah. Okay. Because there is, I mean, there's an argument, and a few critics of yours have made this argument, that something doesn't have to have meaning, literal meaning, in order to be profound and useful, for want of a better word. And you sort of use the example of, say, song lyrics or nonsense poetry, or these, you know, like Tutti Frutti, you know, the Little Richard song Tutti Frutti, or Mbop, or a lot of Paul Simon lyrics don't actually, you know, like the song Mother and Child Reunited is not about a mother and child being reunited. It's about something on the menu at a Chinese restaurant, you know, but it just, and he saw it and went, oh yeah, yeah, eggs stuffed in a chicken, mother and child reunited. Oh, it's very funny. I'm going to write that, put that in a song. But it doesn't actually matter in terms of the pleasure and the emotional meaning, I guess, that we can get from it and the way in which it makes us feel. That's perfectly fine. It doesn't, it only really strays into bullshit territory when there's that, you know, well, like you said, trying to sell supplements, you know, that, that you're trying to get away with something, for want of a better word.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I would say that the thing is that it doesn't have to be pernicious to be bullshit. Bullshitting could be rational, or, you know, or it could be rational to accept bullshit in some cases. Depends on how you're defining rationality. But like, this is why I sort of liked Frankfurt's definition. So going back to like what we used, the random sentences. Sure, it could be the case that an individual, you know, they see the sentence, hidden meaning transforms unparalleled abstract beauty, and then they create some sort of meaning, something that they take away from that that's meaningful. That's fine and good for them, but they're still interpreting something that was literally constructed without any concern for the truth. It's a random sentence, so that it's basically still, it's still bullshit. It's just not, when people, I think the problem is that when people, you know, hear the term bullshit, they, there's connotations that come along with it, but I don't know a better term to use. You know, if anything, we could, but it doesn't mean it's irrational.
No. Sure. Yeah. Like, it certainly, I don't think, needs to be malicious or pernicious, and that in terms of that, what they're trying to get away with. But there is a sense here that Deepak Chopra is trying to get away with something, that he is trying to pass something off. So with all those songs I mentioned, it doesn't really affect our enjoyment of the song to know that they don't actually mean anything and it's meaningless. It's, you know, we're not revealing some great truth by saying that. But in the case of Deepak Chopra, we are. And it really is, I guess, because he is trying to get away with something. And even if what he's trying to get away with might be positive, you know, trying to make people happy, trying to bring them pleasure, it's still deceptive, right? Even if it's not malicious.
Yeah, I mean, he's making truth claims. Like, you say it, he's acting as though... This is the problem with public intellectuals. You need to justify your stance as somebody that people need to listen to, not because you're entertaining. You're not a comedian, or you don't have a podcast, or, you know, whatever it is. It's not because it's entertaining. It's because you will gain knowledge if you listen to me, which means I'm saying things that are true or helpful or meaningful or that have been tested or whatever. And that's where there's the disconnect, I think. I mean, this is now taking off my science hat and just like prognosticating.
But that's what I like. Yeah.
Yeah. To talk about Deepak Chopra in particular, like, that's what, he sold a whole lot of books. Like, he's got, I don't know how many New York Times bestsellers, but it's more than a dozen. I think maybe 20 of them or something. And I don't think there's much meaningful stuff that people could take away from it. Certainly it's not based in anything empirical. It's based in like impressing people with how smart it sounds. And for somebody who probably is very smart, you know, he's got a medical degree and he actually is really smart, it seems. That, to me, it seems like malicious to some extent, you know, like taking advantage of the fact that you can construct words that people are impressed by, but not using that skill to actually figure out what's true and maybe, you know, use all of the massive funds he has to fund research that actually helps understand the nature of human consciousness or whatever. That's the disconnect. I mean, as someone who likes basic science, to have the platform and not use it to actually understand the world, but to just convince people that you understand the world, that seems like a problem to me.
Yeah. Deepak Chopra's response to your study, and your study does criticize him. I think that's like, you know, directly or indirectly, it does it does essentially say that his tweets are bullshit. He says that, I mean, firstly, he says he's very professional skeptic, which that's a direct quote. I mean, I don't, are you a professional skeptic? I mentioned you're a skeptic, you know, like you're professional.
I actually haven't seen, have you sent me the link to that? Because I haven't seen that.
Oh, sorry. I assumed you would be, gosh, if it was me, I would be Googling my name and GPAC Chopra every day. So, yeah, so this was in Quartz Magazine, which is actually, I think it's just a website. And they interviewed him. This is back in 2017. And they asked him about the study. And he said that people like you, well, he doesn't not name you, but he says that you are a professional skeptic and that you're frozen in an obsolete worldview, which is a very Deepak Chopra thing to say. But they actually asked, they presented him with several of the tweets and then asked him to explain what they mean and to actually come back. And so attention and inattention are the mechanics of manifestation. And he then said, so I'll read it. It's very short. It says, Chopra asked me to bring my attention to my right big toe and then to wiggle it. Was it wiggling before you had intention? He says, no, of course not. Attention and inattention bring experience into awareness, manifest an experience that was not there into an experience right now, he explains. And then the author continues, okay, it sounds like a convoluted way of saying that being aware of wanting to do something and deciding to do something then means something takes place, which is entirely, entirely true. If you want to do something and you think about doing it, that's required in order to make that thing happen. If you want to do something, you have to think about it, and then you have to do it.
Actually, I think that's actually empirically wrong, by the way. Yeah, a lot of our behaviors are not at all controlled, or most of them actually aren't.
Sure.
Like, you don't have to think about breathing, for example, or like...
Right. We're not really discussing whether what he says is true or not. We're still at the base level of does it make sense. So he sort of twists his words into some semblance of meaning, but with so much adjusting and readjusting that it's like, well, that's not what you said. No. Like,
But in terms of me being a professional skeptic, I'm not sure exactly what I'm definitely not like that. In fact, I actually, without even knowing that he had said that, now think back to my answer to why we did the study. It was never about, I certainly did not read Deepak Chopra and think, how am I going to bring this guy down? It was completely happenstance. I did came across the website that used his tweets and I was like, okay, what's this guy about? And then we were like, we need to find a way to show that this is a real world phenomenon, not just something that comes from this generator. And that's how we became a target. Like, I don't care about Deepak Chopra and didn't before the thing. I do find it amusing that the whole thing happened that way, but But I'm a psychologist. Like, I care about understanding, like, so go back to his thing about attention, inattention and all that. So one way to, if you were interested in that sort of thing as a person with means, one thing you could do is try to investigate it empirically, which would be like doing studies based on like to understand the nature of human intentionality and so on. Another thing would be to just make up some things and then make the words flowery and then publish books about it, right? And so, you know, not a professional skeptic, but somebody who tries to understand the nature of the world using data, that's how I would describe myself.
Yes, yeah. Which I don't think is an obsolete worldview, as he puts it.
Yeah, right. How could it be?
Yeah, yeah. He does go on to say that he does take the attention as a compliment. He says, there are lots of random quote generators that parody me, which I take as a compliment. They wouldn't be parodying some Joe on the street, right? Which which really echoes what you're talking about, that idea of the public intellectual, the person who, you know, is very, you know, like, was it Oscar Wilde said, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. You know, it's if you're an anti-Deepak Chopra campaigner, I think you probably would not be doing well because you're giving him more attention, exactly. Which is precisely what he wants.
Yeah.
What were some of the other, because you've used this idea, this sort of profundity scale, this method of detecting how profound things are and aren't. You've used it in a variety of different ways. You did a study I saw into neoliberals to see whether neoliberals were more or less likely to fall for pseudo-profound bullshit.
That was driven largely by a different research group, but people associate like new age type stuff with liberalism. We actually found, in contrast to that, it was mostly more people who tend to be more conservative, essentially. Like, neoliberalism is basically economic conservatism. So that was surprising, and that was the nature of the paper. By the way, we did, like, there was a subsequent analysis, though, that was, it seems like it has more to do with, that finding was probably driven more by moderates, meaning that people who were politically apathetic tend to be more interested in these sorts of bullshit claims. And that's probably because they don't spend a lot of time thinking about either politics or the bullshit that they read or whatever. And so it's probably less to do with ideology and more to do with just being disengaged politically.
Sorry, so just to clarify, so moderates or people who sort of see themselves as apolitical, they're more likely
They're more receptive to bullshit,
That's really interesting.
Because think of what it means to not have a stance on... These are American samples, so that's one thing you have to keep in mind. But in the context of American politics, to not have a stance means you have to be really quite disengaged. And to be disengaged means that, like, if you don't like to think about things that much, politics is probably going to be one of those things, and therefore you won't have a stance. But if you don't like thinking about things and you see these kind of flowery sentences, they'll probably sound pretty good to you. And so people who are moderates also tend to be more intuitive. And so moderates is probably the wrong terminology. It's more like politically apathetic, like they're just not engaged.
Often moderates just purely because that's where they've settled in the middle because they haven't given it enough thought to go one way or the other.
I
was surprised by that, but thinking about it, when I associate bullshit with very political people, I think it is actually perhaps, and this is a claim that would require further study, the more political someone is, and perhaps the more radical in either direction they are, I feel like perhaps the more likely they are to be someone who produces bullshit.
It's a key difference between producing it and receiving it. So it's important. Yeah, that's important to keep in mind. The bullshitter versus the bullshittee. Those who have the most motivations to try to convince people to listen to them are going to be the most likely to bullshit, because it benefits them to do so. And I mean, I think it is generally the case, by the way, that people value the truth. We've got research on misinformation. And so, for example, we find that people often share false content online, not because they believe it, but because they haven't even thought about whether it's true. They just kind of reflexively share it. And so it's the same way that I've been talking about the bullshit thing, where it's this tendency to rely on our intuitions and to not engage in deliberation that leads to a lot of these kind of issues.
Can you, and again, this might be outside of the scope of your work, can we train our intuition to be better at spotting bullshit? Because I know for me, when I see a quote like that, I say, oh, yeah, probably bullshit. Or that's not very profound, without considering it. So I will dismiss things as bullshit or as not profound on an instinctual level. And it'd be interesting to know whether people like me who do that, whether our instincts are actually correct, whether the thing, mix in some statements that sound like Deepak Chopra said them, but they are genuinely profound on some level, and to see whether people like me are actually dismiss those sentences, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, for sure, that you can, in fact, a lot of the time when people, there's a very old finding in literature, which is that people who tend to be more intelligent, like say for even basic intelligence, like they have a stronger working memory capacity, for example, tend to do better on tests of heuristics and biases, and they tend to be more rational. Okay. What recent studies have shown is that a lot of that happens because they have better intuitions, not necessarily because they are in every case thinking more deliberately, but because they have better intuitions. And what that means is if you are a more deliberate person, then you've honed your intuitions to be more rational by considering things when you need to. But being deliberative doesn't mean that you're always pausing and thinking about every single thing. It means you pause and think in cases that you need to. And that means that you don't need to double check your intuition. If somebody asks you what your name is, you can respond based on your gut, based on that. And so in many cases, these sentences, if somebody starts using quantum and consciousness and various types of words, if you're well versed in this kind of area, you can use that as a trigger that, oh, maybe there's something, this person is maybe trying to be deceptive. And then you can look in, it depends on the context, but you could look into what the actual meaning is and see if there's something going on there. But it might be the case, like you say, that because you've learned that these terms usually go along with someone saying bullshit, you might be more ready to throw them away than in some contexts would be, you know, necessary or even rational. We have no studies on that, but that's a possibility. I think it's an interesting idea.
Oh, that can be our next study.
Yeah, there you go.
I can be a co-author or a very special thanks to in the bottom, right. Whatever. I'm not sure what the academic version of person who did nothing.
You could go in the acknowledgements.
Acknowledgements, that's it. Thank you. I can be in the acknowledgements. That's all I want. Excellent. Wonderful. Thank you so much for the chat and for the bullshit.
Oh, my pleasure. I appreciate it.